Welcome to Merely Catholic with me, Gavin Ashenden. The religious tourist or pilgrim who visits London will usually visit at least two iconic churches. Westminster Abbey, consecrated as a Catholic abbey in 1065 but taken forcibly for the See of E at the Reformation, and Westminster Cathedral, which was consecrated in 1910, a Catholic cathedral marking the new emergence of Catholicism into the life of the nation. They have very different atmospheres. An atmosphere is, of course, a personal thing. We're not all equally sensitive. We have different kinds of antennae. But the change of ownership of the abbey from Catholic to the Anglican Church involved a wave of iconoclasm that saw the destruction of the deepest and most beautiful aspects of Catholic piety. The iconoclasts set about cleansing the abbey of so-called idolatry. They removed with an energetic thoroughness images of the Virgin Mary and the saints. They stripped out hundreds of yards of medieval windows whose imagery was offensive to the Protestant mind. They created bonfires of images, relics, embroidered altar cloths and broken glass. But all this left some space to be filled, and so Anglicanism began to fill the emptiness left by the evacuation of the saints, with tributes instead to politicians and great men of the Protestant state. And so the abbey became more of a monument to the achievement of the state it served than a centre of worship moulded by the character of universal Christendom. Before I became a Catholic, if I needed to spend any time in prayer when in London, I, like so many others, would head for Westminster Cathedral rather than the abbey. The gap between earth and heaven was much narrower in the cathedral, it seemed to me. Not only did it contain more Christian iconography than secular, but it was always full of praying people. I remember, too, the holy shock I got the first time I walked in and almost walked into the body of St. John Southworth, contained in a feretry. He was surrounded by blazing candles and a vivid account of his martyrdom. There had been no relics of Christian martyrs to bump into at the Protestant Abbey. And I was deeply moved by the inscription of his last words before execution. "My faith and obedience to my superiors is all the treason charged against me. Nay, I die for Christ's law, which no human law, by whomsoever made, ought to withstand or contradict. To follow his holy doctrine and imitate his holy death, I willingly suffer at present. This gallows I look upon as his cross, which I gladly take to follow my dear Saviour. I plead not for myself, but for you, poor persecuted Catholics, whom I leave behind me." Now, it might be thought good manners for departing Anglicans to say as little as possible about the deficiencies of the church they left behind them. Deficiencies, if one is honest, which had played a part in impelling the departure. But it would be less than honest, not wholly truthful, and perhaps to those still struggling, unhelpful to keep such a silence. So hardly a month goes by without the news that an ancient, formerly Catholic cathedral curated by the C of E has launched yet another entertainment centre to attract visitors. Miniature golf courses, helter-skelters, gin festivals, film festivals are all used to get punters into a building lured by the prospect of entertainment rather than pilgrimage. Not everyone thinks this is congruent with the intrinsic nature of a Christian cathedral. And whilst they've become forcible custodians of former Catholic shrines, many think they don't quite know how to look after them or live with them. But we're living through a moment of rapid cultural change, and as the C of E loses its hold on the imagination of the state, there are, for the first time since the 16th century, more poor persecuted Catholics, which St. John Southwold left behind him, than there are practising Anglicans. 10% of the Catholic parish clergy are former Anglicans who fled the C of E. And if this trajectory continues, it poses a question as to when Catholics allow themselves to begin to see Catholicism as the resurrected Christian Church of the English, a Christian presence that was brutally but temporarily interrupted by the Reformation experiment. Is this then a significant moment in the history of Catholic England? Neither the stability of the Protestant monarchy nor the Protestant Church of England can be taken for granted as the tectonic plates of cultural change clash ever more frenetically. Is this then the moment for a gear change in the reinvigoration of Catholic English identity and responsibility? Father Dwight Longenecker is an American Catholic priest and a highly regarded author and spiritual director. He's a former Anglican vicar and offers one of the best informed clerical perspectives on English Christianity. He's recently returned to England to lead a pilgrimage for American Catholics, reacquainting themselves with the history and experience of a thousand and more years of Catholic England. I wanted to put some of these issues to him, and he joins me now. Father Dwight, it's great to see you again. Although you're not looking at your best, you've been ill, you caught COVID in Europe. Tell me, first of all, how are you?
Oh, I'm doing pretty well. I was in England for 10 days leading a pilgrimage tour focusing on the English martyrs and English literary figures with a bunch of Americans. At the end of the tour, just got hit with COVID, so decided to come home and recover here rather than stay holed up in a hotel in Heathrow for 10 days.
Sounds very sensible. This pilgrimage sounds very exciting. How did your fellow pilgrims respond to what you were showing them? Was this the first time for them? Were they particularly excited about the English Catholic inheritance?
Yeah, I mean, on a pilgrimage like this, we advertise it a year in advance, and it attracts like-minded people. In other words, people who have an interest not only in their Catholic faith, but in England and the story of England, the literary figures of England. So it tends to be a bit specialist. We only had 25 people on the tour, which was fine, but it was a great group, and we had a wonderful time together.
And where did you go? You've written an article in the diary of the Catholic Herald, this month's edition, describing it.
Yeah, well, when they landed Heathrow, we hit the ground running because there's no time to waste. They've paid a lot of money for this pilgrimage tour. So we went directly to Tyburn Convent, where we celebrated Mass for the first day. Then they climbed back on the bus and do a tour of London. This was at the beginning of the Jubilee week, so London was packed, and so it was quite exciting to be there that day. Ended up at Westminster Abbey and did a tour of Westminster Abbey, and then had some lunch, went on to Westminster Cathedral and viewed the Mother Church of Catholics there, and was able to explain to them some of the complicated history, of course, so that when we're in Westminster Abbey, they view the tombs of Elizabeth I and Mary Tudor and Mary Queen of Scots, of course, all piled up together there in the same place, which is complicated enough. And then when we go to Westminster Cathedral, we begin to unfold some of the history of English Catholicism for them. And one of the big points of confusion for them as American Catholics is to try to figure out what is this strange thing called Anglo-Catholicism. And so when we would visit Anglican churches, for instance, at Walsingham, which looks much more Catholic than the Catholic shrine, and they're trying scratching their head and saying, so this is, Father, is this Catholic? And I'm saying, well, it's Anglo-Catholic. And what is that? You know, so they're trying to figure out this strange and unusual beast called Anglo-Catholicism.
Okay, Dwight, so you're an Oxford-educated Anglo-American who's been an Anglican priest. If anybody knows what Anglo-Catholicism is, you do. Before I ask you to give a frank expression of it, I heard a lovely old Anglican convert to Catholicism talk about the way in which he was quite determined never to say a bad word about Anglicanism because it was a matter of affection and respect. And I thought that was a lovely attitude. But the trouble is, it doesn't allow you to tell the truth. So if we're going to tell the truth in love, what is Anglo-Catholicism?
Well, there is also the prevailing wind of sentimentalism in our society today, in which any form of critique at all of anybody in any way is simply not allowed. And you get blasted for it as being mean, as being racist, as being unkind, as being unecumenical, as being unchristian or whatever. And so very often the desire, especially of my English friends, to hide behind good manners and to say, well, I really don't want to offend anybody, is a weakness, which one can speak the truth in love, as we say. One can speak the truth and speak without trying to offend anybody. And the fact of the matter is Anglo-Catholicism is very English. It's quintessentially English, as they say, but it's not quintessentially Catholic.
It's always seemed to me that Anglo-Catholics are people with a highly developed taste for the transcendent and for the sacramental, but they want the beauty without paying the price for it. Catholics have paid a high price for being Catholic in England, and it seems to me that Anglo-Catholics wanted all the benefits without paying for it personally.
Yes, one of the things that, it's a small detail, but one of the things which I always found amusing was how the Anglo-Catholics would sneer at Catholic shrines, which were surrounded with items of poor taste. So if you went to the continent and visited Lourdes or Lisieux or one of those places and had to walk past those stalls with rosary beads clattering in the wind and shelves full of glow-in-the-dark Virgin Mary statues and all the rest of that sort of tasteless Catholic paraphernalia. Anglo-Catholics would sneer at that as being in such poor taste. And I always thought, well, you know, this proves to me that Catholicism is universal. It's for poor people with poor taste as well as for rich people with good taste. And so I don't want to get rid of those stalls with clattering rosaries and glow-in-the-dark Marys, because it shows that my Catholic faith is universal. It appeals to the high and the low, if you like.
One of the things that surprised me most about Tyburn, where you visited, was the fact that although I was a London boy, I grew up in southwest London. I went to school there as a child, although at 13 I went to Canterbury. My mother ended up by living in a flat round the corner from Marble Arch. I must have been in my 30s when I discovered that Tyburn was Marble Arch. I don't think many people know that Marble Arch is where they executed people at Tyburn. You were surprised at how few Catholics pay any attention to this place of execution for the martyrs in the middle of London.
Yeah, the site of Tyburn Tree, of course, is right there at Marble Arch. They have a small slate plaque set into the pavement, which marks the spot. I believe someone told me there are some plans to erect a more prominent memorial to the Tyburn Tree. But just a few yards from the slate memorial in the pavement, of course, is Tyburn Convent, a convent which is established by the Sisters of Montmartre. It's a place of perpetual adoration in the heart of London. And what surprises me is whenever we do one of these pilgrimages, we go there and say Mass. And in the basement is a special shrine with relics of the martyrs, as much as was possible, because, of course, most of their bodies were desecrated and thrown to the four winds. And there was a deliberate attempt on the part of the Reformation authorities to deny the ability of any of the faithful saving relics. So they deliberately destroyed the bodies so that relic hunters would not go there and take any pieces of the bodies of the martyrs. Anyway, at Tyburn, there's a little sort of shrine in the basement with an altar. The altar is set within a reconstruction of the Tyburn Tree. So it's really quite a moving place to celebrate Mass. However, with respect to our hosts at the Tyburn Convent, the access to the convent, the lighting and the furnishing and the redecoration of the shrine downstairs, it could all use a bit of a touch-up. It could be more welcoming. They could have more professional sort of publicity and promotion for the shrine. It seems to be sadly neglected. And I was wondering how many Catholics even know about the Tyburn Convent and know about the shrine. How many Catholic school students in London, for instance, know about the Tyburn Tree and the Tyburn Martyrs and the Tyburn Shrine?
I think the answer has to be not enough. One of the things we've been discovering since a scandal in Catholic schools in London with the attempt of a gay author to turn the Lord's Prayer to a form of blasphemous reading was that only half the teachers in Catholic schools in London and England are actually Catholic, and the rest are entirely secular. So I imagine that there isn't a great sense of cultural Catholic identity in the schools, but that probably reflects the way Catholics haven't grasped a full sense of their own identity after being excluded since the Reformation from public affairs.
What strikes me is that this goes to the root of a deeper problem in our society generally, and that is an indifference about history and a disregard for the actual history of our ancestors that we've lived. And this applies to the Catholic Church and the Catholics in England, as well as to the general population. History doesn't really matter. It's almost as if everybody's adopted Henry Ford's dictum that history is bunk. You know, the famous saying, and disregarding history as if it doesn't matter. But of course, the more we disregard history, the more it will repeat itself.
My own journey to Catholicism was spurred on its way by praying in Westminster Cathedral. And I think almost anybody will agree that there are difficulties in trying to pray in Westminster Abbey, which is very beautiful, full of history, but very much without any numinous atmosphere. And I remember being shocked when I went in to pray in Westminster and saw the body of a martyr that had been preserved in a coffin, and was astonished when I read his life story. I began to reread the Reformation. And as you say, it's reading the history that begins to introduce you to it. As an Anglican, I was very angry when Catholics said, "You've stolen our cathedrals." But it turns out that I was bamboozled by state propaganda, because the state really did steal Catholic cathedrals. And one of the problems is it doesn't know how to use them, which is why they're being filled with golf courses and fairground equipment at the moment. What did the Catholics you brought with you think of the way in which Anglicanism has stewarded the holy places that were originally Catholic?
Well, it's all summed up by the contrast between Westminster Cathedral and Westminster Abbey. When you go into Westminster Abbey, it's always struck me as a wonderful and strange irony that at the Protestant Reformation, the Protestants and the Puritans would have yanked out all of the statues of saints because they were idolatrous. But over the years, they've been replaced by statues of English statesmen. So that kind of says it all, that Westminster Abbey is a museum to the state religion of Anglicanism. And I explained to my pilgrims, I said, you would need to understand that the Church of England is the Church of England. Okay, it's the ecclesiastical form of the royal family. Okay, it is a national church. It is a nationalistic church. It conforms itself to the zeitgeist in England at in any particular age. Westminster Abbey stands for that. But when we went down the road to Westminster Cathedral, they immediately said, well, this is a house of prayer, because they went in and they immediately saw an image of the Divine Mercy. As you say, they saw the Stations of the Cross. They saw the Blessed Sacrament Chapel. They saw the Lady Chapel. They knew they were in a Catholic church and they were there to pray, which was a beautiful thing to see. So this is one of the best ways to experience the difference, is to visit these two famous landmarks in the heart of London.
You went to see a number of other places too. It was not just a church tour, it was a literary tour. And you went to see the places where Catholic authors wrote and worked. How was that for you and for the group? What did you discover?
Yeah, well, we went from London, we went on to Canterbury, and I was traveling with Professor David Deevil, an American professor of English and theology here in the States. And we did various lectures on the bus as we traveled. So as we traveled to Canterbury and did a mini Canterbury pilgrimage, Professor Deevil spoke on Chaucer and his life and times, and I did a talk called The Three Toms, which is about Thomas Becket, Thomas More, and T.S. Eliot, whose play Murder in the Cathedral was performed first in the Chapter House there at Canterbury. So the literary figures and the martyrs blended together pretty well. While we were there, we visited the ruins of St. Augustine Abbey, and they were able to experience the suppression of the monasteries and also learn more about the history of St. Augustine of Canterbury coming here and sent by Pope St. Gregory the Great and so forth. And so from London the next day, we went on to Cambridge, Ely, stopped at Oxborough Hall, which is again a very neglected Catholic shrine where a recusant family has stayed faithful through the hundreds of years of persecution. You can visit a climb into a wonderful priest hole there and experience the difficulties of the priests who were in hiding during the Elizabethan police state. On to Walsingham, and then from there we went to stop at the little church of Little Gidding and had learned more about T.S. Eliot and Nicholas Ferrer and the community there, before going on to Stratford and learning about Shakespeare the Catholic, then on to Oxford.
But before you go any further, Shakespeare the Catholic is a fascinating subject. Which side of the coin did you come down on in terms of his own personal allegiance?
Oh, I'm firmly convinced that he was a secret Catholic, and that not only that, that he wove secret Catholic themes into his plays. There's been a good bit of literature on this over the last sort of couple of decades, and the circumstantial evidence is pretty convincing.
Well, that's quite exciting, and to anyone interested in Shakespeare and his personal allegiances, which of course he hid for all kinds of commercial and political reasons, that remains an enormously fertile area. Did you go and visit the houses of Tolkien and G.K. Chesterton?
We visited Tolkien's grave in Wolvercote Cemetery, North Oxford, and that little area of the cemetery is the Catholic corner of the cemetery. But in addition to Tolkien now, Tolkien's daughter is buried a few sort of grave places away, but also Walter Hooper, who died recently, who was C.S. Lewis's secretary, a fellow American, fellow Anglican priest who converted to the Catholic faith. It was nice to see his place and say a prayer for Walter's soul. And next to him, a few steps down, was a poet, Elizabeth Jennings, a Catholic poet, who was also resident in Oxford. I forget the name of that famous cemetery in Paris, where there's so many famous people are all buried together. Is it the Père Lachaise Cemetery? The Catholic cemetery in Wolvercote is now becoming a bit like that, with numerous famous names from the Catholic world and the Catholic literary world all being buried in that same place.
My own view is that C.S. Lewis would have become a Catholic, although he was an Ulsterman and had residual Ulsterish reflexes. Mentally and philosophically and aesthetically and spiritually, he seems to me to have been firmly on the way to becoming a Catholic.
Yes, the best book on that is Joseph Pierce's book, C.S. Lewis and the Catholic Church, in which he explains the implicit Catholicism within Lewis's work and thought, but also explains the personal reasons and the cultural reasons why that step was a bit too much for Lewis.
You were a bit disappointed about Chesterton's house, that G.K. Chesterton's house wasn't saved by the Catholic community in the same way that C.S. Lewis's was saved by evangelical Americans for the Christian heritage.
Yeah, during my time living in England, and also I was reminded during this visit of the bewildering lack of initiative and knowledge about Catholic literary heritage amongst the English Catholics themselves. So I know I'm an enthusiastic American Anglophile, and I hope people will forgive that. You know, I found that they were a bit embarrassed by it when I went over to England. This American should be more English than the English and so forth. And so I apologize for that and admit it. But at the same time, I'm saying, well, I'm enthusiastic about Tolkien and Chesterton and Lewis. And now that I'm a Catholic, I'm also saying, why are English Catholics so indifferent and so ignorant about their own wonderful Catholic literary heritage? I mean, Chesterton's influence on literature and on the culture and on the history of England, therefore, is enormous. And Tolkien is repeatedly voted as the most important author and the most well-loved author of the 20th century. And yet, when Tolkien's house came on the market a couple of years ago, why did English Catholics not spearhead a campaign to raise the money to buy that house and turn it into a Catholic cultural center? Even from a financial point of view, an entrepreneur should have picked it up and said, right, let's turn this place into a Tolkien powerhouse for tourists who come to England. I would argue thousands of tourists come to England and they're interested in Tolkien, interested in learning more about Tolkien, and to not buy his house and turn it into a center for a visit and to share the Catholic faith, it seems madness. It reminded me of what happened to Chesterton's house. Top Meadow in Beaconsfield ended up being owned by a Catholic charity. It was not only Chesterton's house, but it was filled with Chesterton's furniture, his books, his library, his memorabilia. And yet, in the 70s, I think it was, or maybe the 80s, this charity just put it on the open market, cleared out all the stuff, sent it to auction, put the house on open market. Now it's a private dwelling. So why did English Catholics allow this to happen? Why did nobody step up and say, this is part of our heritage, part of English heritage, part of English literary heritage. This needs to be preserved for posterity. But nobody did. And it's a mystery to me. It's a puzzle.
I think the Catholic Emancipation Act clearly cleared the way for Catholics to play a full part in society by allowing them access to the professions and the universities. But there hasn't really been a cultural emancipation act. Perhaps you can't legislate for that. It was Soren Kierkegaard, wasn't it, who said our tragedy is we live life forwards but only understand it backwards. I only noticed that I had been brought up as a cultural snob recently. And one of the bits of my snobbishness was that Roman Catholicism was something that un-English people did. So they were Italians and the Irish did it. And there was the occasional aristocratic family like the Duke of Norfolk. But nobody else was a Catholic, because to be Catholic was to be take the wrong side in the Armada and be on the wrong side of English history since the Reformation. Now, I think that's all now completely bunk and wrong, and I was misled, and I'm learning to re-understand history. But it does seem to me that English Catholics don't have much or enough self-confidence and self-belief. And this is particularly sad when the Church of England is giving up on Christianity and leaving a vacuum at the heart of our nation for a Christian witness, which ought to be filled by the Catholic Church.
Yes, the lack of entrepreneurial spirit, and I say that not in a money-making way. When I say entrepreneurial spirit, I simply mean seeing an opportunity and stepping up and doing something about it seems to me to be endemic in the English Catholic Church. There's a kind of indifference to actually getting on and doing anything positive in this way, which maybe I'm again just an aggressive American, if you like. But it just seems to me very, very sad that these opportunities are missed. I mean, not only Chesterton and Tolkien, there doesn't seem to be any permanent memorial or permanent recognition of other literary figures like Benson, like Ronnie Knox, and these other important Catholic literary figures who had a huge influence on the culture in the 20th century. And they're Catholics and they were faithful Catholics, but it's the Catholic Church is almost ashamed or embarrassed by these things.
Even Graham Greene and Evelyn Waugh are not taken for being Catholic protagonists first. I mean, they're obviously taken as being wonderful authors, but their Catholicism is often seen as being almost an eccentric add-on rather than an integral part of who they were and how they thought and wrote.
Yes, I can remember when I was an Anglican curate mentioning something about the Catholic Church or my attraction to it, and my rector, who was a dyed-in-the-wool, sort of bluff, hearty, sort of Anglican vicar type, he just laughed and he said, "Oh yes, the Roman Catholics," he said. "It's all well and good for the Irish navvies and the Italian waiters, but not for us."
Yeah, that's exactly the cultural snobbishness I was brought up in and I'm now deeply ashamed of and I'm having to repent of. But it's endemic. It's absolutely everywhere. And it's certainly riddled throughout the Church of England, which is one of the reasons why so many Anglicans are increasingly astonished and outraged that there's this constant flow of ex-Anglicans into the Roman Catholic Church as they seek a way of being faithful to Christ ecclesiastically and realize that the Protestant experiment is not standing up to time.
Yeah, and when so many of us actually go across to the Catholic Church, the Anglicans don't really seem to answer it or register it. It's just like, well, it was an error in taste. That person is dead to us, you know.
Yes, you really do feel like you've died and gone into a different dimension. They don't talk about you anymore. And everything you did has a sort of slight shadow of suspicion.
From the Anglican's point of view, you didn't swim the Tiber, you drowned in the Tiber, okay?
Yes, that's right. Exactly the case. So in terms of the Catholic Church in England, what were you left with as an impression? I mean, obviously you dove in and out quite quickly, but you haven't been back to England for a while. What were your impressions about some of the changes that have taken place insofar as you could grasp any of this cultural background radiation?
Well, we pilgrims received a warm welcome by the Catholics when we actually went into Catholic churches. So I don't really have any complaint about that. We celebrated Mass at Norwich Cathedral on the Vigil of Pentecost, and then we had an icon celebrated Mass with the rector of the cathedral, and it was a beautiful experience. The church was quite full, and also at Walsingham the next day on the Sunday morning of Pentecost, the church was full and the Mass was celebrated beautifully and simply. So that seemed to be pretty healthy in that respect. I do understand, though, that from some of my Catholic friends in England that there are signs of real terminal decline in Mass numbers and in ordinations, and that there are things, spiritually speaking and from a human point of view, are just not good.
Well, I think there's a mixed message, isn't there? That's quite right. There are things that are decaying and require renewing, but there are also signs of renewal. I mean, I think, for example, the fact that 1 in 10 of all Catholic priests in England is an ex-Anglican is a sign of how deep the renewal has flowed from that direction. I think when you and I were younger, that would have been a very unlikely scenario.
Yeah, and I'm not surprised to hear that. And I would think that the numbers in the pews are equally reflective, except for the swelling of numbers due to immigration in England. Because I understand that while the Catholic churches tend to be more full than Anglican churches, they're full of Poles and Czechs and other Eastern Europeans and Asians who are coming in.
Well, that's true. But all that means is there's time for an evangelistic initiative to the English. And who better to do that than converted Anglican clergy? So you're quite right about that. One of the things that's exciting Pope watchers are the mixed signs that are coming out of the Vatican at the moment, that with Pope Francis's declining health and mobility issues, the fact that he seems to be following in Benedict's footsteps just before he resigned, maybe suggesting that he might be willing to contemplate resignation himself. And we will once again have a year of three popes, though for very different reasons than we did in earlier centuries. Do you have any views on the papacy and its future and what might happen?
Yes, I'm a bit reluctant to follow rumor too much. And I also regard the idea of three popes with some trepidation, realizing that we had three popes once before, if I remember my history correctly, and it did not end happily. But on the other hand, if Pope Francis does step away, and I think I heard a version that he planned to reside at St. John Lateran at the Lateran Palace, which is, of course, the cathedral seat of the Bishop of Rome. And so you would have Pope Benedict still living in his monastic retreat in the Vatican. You would have Pope Francis living in monastic retreat at the Lateran, and then you would have Francis II, or whoever gets elected, who's actually the Pope, perhaps living in the Apostolic Palace. Who that would be, I haven't studied the list of cardinals very well, but it seems to me that the future is African and Asian, and I would not be at all surprised if we see an African Pope or an Asian Pope, and it would be a reminder to us that the church is not just European. And remember, Francis is a first-generation immigrant from Italy, so he's a European, although he's from Argentina. And it's certainly not American. And I would look with hope and anticipation to the future, and that it would actually be, you know, that we're moving into a new era of evangelization for the 21st century.
So the Catholic Church is experiencing its own version of the culture wars, with Latin Mass and traditionalist or restorationist, as their critics have begun to call them. Do you see the direction that Pope Francis has set in terms of progressive agenda as being one that's either unstoppable, or will usual Catholic equilibrium come and we'll find ourselves with something to balance it in the next appointment? How do you think the cardinals will react?
Well, I personally feel that a lot of the woke agenda and the progressive agenda is just an ideology, and ideologies are always built, they're houses of cards that are built out of half-truths. And they crumble very easily under the weight of circumstances and under the weight of truth, actually. And the only way they can be maintained and is finally by force. So we will either move into a situation where these ideologies are enforced with muscle and police force and with all sorts of economic sanctions, or they will simply crumble and drift away and wither away in the face and the onslaught of the light of truth. I hope for the latter conclusion, of course, not the former. And the church is caught up in these things in the same way. And if it turns into a situation of force, where these ideologies are forced on people, then the church will come under a time of persecution.
Father Dwight, you're suffering from the after effects of COVID and you're trying to convalesce. It was very kind of you to take the time and the trouble and give energy which you might have kept for getting better to us. Thank you so much for sharing your conversation with us. God bless you and thank you.
Thanks again for the invitation. Always good to talk to you.